everybody. Welcome. Thanks for tuning in wherever you're from. It's good to have you here. I hope you're doing well today. This is Henrik, and you're listening to the one and only Red Eyes Radio. Today, we are going to talk about the giants, the ancient giants who ruled America, the missing skeletons, and the great Smithsonian cover-up. We have with us the author, Richard Dewhurst. He's also an Emmy Award-winning writer of the HBO-featured documentary Dear America, Letters Home from Vietnam, a graduate of New York University with degrees in journalism, film, and television. He has written and edited for the History Channel, the Arts and Entertainment Channel, PBS, Fox Television and Fox Films, ABC News, TNT, Paramount Pictures, and the Miami Herald. Interesting discussion is coming up. Stay with us. Richard, hi and welcome. Thanks for coming on Red Eyes Radio. Great to talk to you and great to have you here.
It's a real pleasure to be on your show.
Excellent. Now, great job on the book, first of all, here. I mean, fascinating and highly insightful study into this particular kind of research. I think it compiles the largest archives of old reports of giants that I've seen so far. So great job, first of all, Richard, on the book.
Well, thank you very much. It was really an incredible experience when I started to get into the research. I subscribed to several online newspaper archive services that covered several hundred years of reports, and as I began to compile these articles, I could not believe what I was reading. These were not hoaxes, or these were major reports from the Smithsonian universities around the country, leading scientists, very detailed, and they literally had reports from every state in the United States.
Exactly. It's just an amazing, you know, amount of evidence that's compiled here. Before we just kind of get into the meat of this then, Richard, what led you to this yourself? What's, you know, sparked your interest in this?
Well, the short answer is that I'm tall. I'm 6'6", and I've had a lifelong interest in giant stories. And I'm also a documentary filmmaker and a journalist. So over the years, I collected a sort of Fortean file with references to giants being found around America, and most of them were very short nubs or reference things. And so to get to the bottom of it, I subscribed to a couple of newspaper archive services that covered 300 or 400 years of newspaper reports in the United States. And that's when I really started to crack the thing. And I found that I could use word search when I didn't have any specific dates or anything. So I started putting in headline searches for giant skeletons in Earth, I think was the first one I put in there. And I got 30 hits. And I was just astonished at what I was reading. When I started telling my friends what I was finding, no one would believe me. They would just say, "Who says? That's impossible. It was a hoax." So I thought, well, I better reproduce these in the book so you can read them for yourself and make up your own mind.
Indeed, and it's a fascinating read. It is. Some of them are just extraordinary. And this seems to have been, I mean, more or less widely known at the time of these reports. I mean, as evidenced by that quote that you bring out from Abraham Lincoln right in the beginning of the book.
Well, exactly. Abraham Lincoln was giving a speech in Niagara Falls in 1848 in which he said, "The eyes of that extinct species of giant, whose bones fill the mounds of America, have gazed on Niagara as ours do now." And that quote is amazing for a number of reasons. First of all, that Abraham Lincoln said it. Number two, that it shows how widespread the knowledge of the giants in the 19th century were. We were an agrarian society. The people were plowing fields all over America and turning up giant bones everywhere. The other interesting point is that an ancient town of giants was found on the Canadian-U.S. border near Niagara Falls with several hundred giants, houses with chimneys. They even found a blacksmith shop with 2 tons of charcoal and evidence of gold and silver work. And then close to there in Cayuga, New York, they found what was called the Cemetery of Giants. That was 200 skeletons, 7 to 9 feet tall. A little farther down the state on the Pennsylvania line, they found 150 skeletons, 7 feet tall. And this continues all the way down the coast of America and all the way across the middle of America and out to Catalina Island in California, which is one of the most astonishing stories you'll ever hear, what they found out there.
I definitely want to get into that later. I mean, that's extraordinary. And why don't we cover a little bit of the history first and maybe kind of just see and kind of paint the picture, I guess, a little bit for our audience. And how would you describe the real history of America, North America, as opposed to the Smithsonian official view that we've been fed for such a long time?
Well, let's get to the nub of it. The Smithsonian, when they started out, they published their first book in 1848 on the ancient monuments of the Mississippi Valley. It was an incredibly open-minded study with beautiful drawings of all of the mound builder finds that they had made in the middle of the country. Now, we're not talking about American Indians here. We're talking about what they refer to as the mound builder culture. And that predates the Indians, and it reached its height probably around 1200 AD. But we're now getting dates all the way back to 10,000 BC. And this mound builder culture is pervasive. The Smithsonian report itself said there were several hundred thousand mounds in the United States. Now, in 1879, Major John Wesley Powell, who was a famous Western explorer, was made the first head of the Bureau of Ethnology. In 1879, he issued what was called the Powell Doctrine. And the Powell Doctrine forbade any evidence of pre-Columbus contact in the Americas. He said, we're dealing with Aboriginal savages who are illiterate. There's no signs of higher intelligence. Basically, it was carte blanche for manifest destiny, and also one of the cornerstones of the Smithsonian was the theory of evolution. And the theory of evolution, in a nutshell, says that we keep getting bigger and smarter over time. And you can't very well have 7 to 12 foot giants everywhere in America and argue that we're getting bigger and smarter. So,
nope.
That pretty much, and they've never rescinded the Powell Doctrine. So in case after case after case, these skeletons are being sent to the Smithsonian and just disappearing. In the book 1491, he estimates that Ailes Hedricka, who was the head of the Smithsonian from the turn of the century, and the man that came up with the absurd Bering Land Strait, they all came, you know, down from Asia. They estimated in that book that he had secreted over 30,000 skeletons during his tenure and refused to examine them.
What happened with them then? Do we know?
Well, I think it's kind of like that Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. They put them in boxes and they go off somewhere into the memory hole.
Yeah.
There's, you know, a couple of cases where somebody's actually... The Fowler Museum in UCLA purports to have 200 of the skeletons found out in Catalina, but that's a whole other story we can get into. The Smithsonian, on the other hand, is completely not forthcoming at all.
Now, who would you say, if we could try to tackle that question a little bit, of who actually discovered America, or has it always been inhabited, do you think?
Well, this is very curious. You know, some of the finds, including... the Spirit Cave mummies, which were found out in Nevada, they were discovered in the 1940s by the University of Nevada under several feet of bat guano. And they were incredibly well preserved, red hair, still intact, and covered in an incredibly finely woven fabric made out of tule reed, which is like papyrus. These things were dated at the time to be 1,000 years old and promptly filed away. And several years ago, a University of California researcher heard about them. He got one of them, carbon dated it, to 7,500 BC.
Huh.
We're talking about advanced weaving and mummification in the Americas at 7,500 BC. So at one point, I say, well, maybe... we discovered them, and they didn't discover us.
Exactly, yeah.
but the related finds, especially in the Newark Earthworks and up in Iowa along the Mississippi River, there's evidence of hieroglyphs, Egyptian writing, Roman coins. There's Hebrew holy stones that they found. The list just goes on and on. Viking, Celtic, Scythian, Asian, Hindu. I think everyone knew we were here, except kids that go to school in America these days.
How do you think we should approach these reports and the potentialities of people, you know, wanting to have that here? You bring out that in the book that there was a struggle at the time, even with the Mormon religion, in the fact that they, you know, talked about the lost tribe of Israel made their way over here, etc. You have this maybe also a willful mythologization of sorts that people wanted maybe that this to be something more. Should we take all of the reports at face value and believe them, do you think?
Well, the question of the Mormon religion is very interesting. John Wesley Powell's father was a preacher in Palmyra, New York, which is up in the same area of New York State that I just told you where they found all these giants and evidence of gold and silver work. His entire congregation was taken from him by the Mormons. So John Wesley Powell had a particular sore spot regarding the Mormons. And in his first paper, which was issued in 1879 on the restriction of certain anthropological data, he goes out of his way to say, and we will not consider the evidence of any lost tribes in America.
Yeah.
And in Newark, Ohio, where a number of giants have been found, Ohio University has in their collection what they call the Holy Stone, which is a condensed version of the Ten Commandments, and some ritual cleansing bowls, which have been dated to the Second Temple. So it does raise some interesting religious questions as well.
I mean, when we think about this, then, if we consider diffusion as a cultural diffusion as opposed to walking over the Bering's land bridge there, we have a potential situation where different peoples for thousands of years have traveled over to America. I mean, there is this with the copper mines, which seems to have pretty established that it might have been trade routes going back to,
absolutely,
I don't know, 2,000 years, right?
Well, the copper mines in Keweenaw Peninsula in northern Michigan are some of the most interesting, fascinating things I ran across in the book. Right north of the tip of the peninsula is something called Isle Royale, which is an island that's virtually made out of copper. And it's the highest quality, purest copper in the world because of the volcanic upthrust. The copper was all exposed to the air and the sulfur impurities burned off. Now, they've got evidence of mining there that go back 10,000 years. And there was two professors from Michigan that published a book that estimated 1.5 billion tons of copper were taken out of there.
Huh.
Now, the kings and queens and the giants in the mounds that I go through in the book are almost always covered in copper jewelry, copper crowns, copper armor, micas, often in association with that. But that in no way accounts or the extraordinary amount of copper that was taken out of there. And there's indications, there's some rock art I saw that looked like a boat from Crete had been engraved. And there's stories of monolithic docks up there, quays, dams, all kinds of things. So there's, and also I even ran across, they won't test the European copper for the Michigan signature, but I did see a passing reference to Oxford University tested one piece and found out it was from Michigan. So.
Really? How would they go about doing that? It's just so distinctly different, right, so you could see it?
Its purity is over 99%.
Right.
So it's so unique that it just, once you test one, you can recognize its signature almost anywhere. And also, their copper working techniques were superior to anything we have. They had used annealing, which was hot and cold water and cold hammering and some other processes, which I think involved carbon from the fires that they would light around the copper veins. But report after report says these axes are as strong as steel. We don't understand how they were made.
So, who do you think was responsible for the mines, for the mining?
Well, again, there's huge finds of giants up there. I mean, basically, what we're talking about is not that America was populated exclusively with giants, but that the ruling class was composed of giants. And mound after mound after mound, the central burial is of a giant. Sometimes he's surrounded in a sun circle burial with 10 warriors with their feet pointing at him. I have a great series of reports out of Tennessee and Kentucky that was done by Dr. John Haywood in 1823, where he went over 100 years of the stuff they had been finding there, and they found 9-foot blonde-haired giants in secret caves with rollaway stones, sacred springs, standing burials with monoliths around them. Just extraordinary stuff. And very specific, you know, in terms of, you know, here's where it was located. It was on this road. It was found by this guy. It was witnessed by these scientists. It was taken to the town over and over again.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems to be, I've wondered about this as well, if the stature of the people has to do something with the land and with the geology or something like that as well, because it seems like you talk about the Lenape, the Delaware Indians, for example, and they were very tall, right?
Yes, yes. And their legends go very far back and tie into the high culture that existed out in the deserts in the western part of the United States that basically came to an end around 5000 BC. As a result of the Lassen volcano explosion. And as I said, we had very advanced mummification weaving found out there, dated carbon-14, dated 7,500 BC. The Lenape legends say that they were forced to migrate east. And when they crossed the Mississippi Valley, they ran into the ruling race of giants there, which were the Allegheny or Allegwai Indians. And that it was a series of epic battles that were joined in by another group that were called the Menengue, who apparently also were giants. And the Allegwai were defeated and driven south, and the Lenape made it all the way across the country and were found all over the New York, Delaware, Pennsylvania area up until the time of the settlers.
And it seems that we have maybe potentially few survivors at the time, and you still have sporadic population of giants, but they've slowly just kind of disappeared and died out. Or how do we explain that? Or was it hunting?
Well, the legends that I found by the Indians, and the Indians over and over again also, I've got to add, they always say, we didn't build these mounds, we didn't clear these fields, we didn't do any of this.
Yeah,
giants did, you know, and the height of their culture existed for thousands of years and seemed to have gone into a collapse between 1200 and 1500 AD. I have some remnant stories out west of what were called the Sitaka, or the red-haired giants, and the Paiute Indians tell a story that they drove the last of them into Lovelock Cave and set a huge fire and burned them out. It's curious that in my research I found out that they did excavations in Lovelock Cave, and under Bat Guano, once again, they found evidence of a fire, and under that they found 6 giant skeletons with red hair. We must take a lot of these Indian myths and legends a lot more seriously.
Indeed, I definitely agree with that. I think you do have a cross, you know, you could correlate these stories with things that was going on in Europe as well. We have the myth of Beowulf and the Jotuns up in the north. You know, it's worldwide, right?
I could not agree more. Yeah. I think what we're looking at is, I'd hate to call it the Atlantean culture, but I think that there was a worldwide culture that was ruled by giants. All the stories of the Titans, Goliath, so on and so forth. There's a very interesting story, quote I have in the Bible from Numbers, where they talk about going into a strange land ruled by the sons of Anak, who come from the giants. And it says, "We standing before them, we look like grasshoppers." And if you look at the sons of Anak as a name, you'll notice that it's very similar to the Anunnaki,
right,
which are from a Sumerian legend. It's also very similar to the Anastasi, who are the cliff dwellers out west, and the name that they used for the ancient ones that were the copper miners in Michigan.
Fascinating. Now, let's see if we can talk about if you believe that there were different people, cultures, races, whatever you want to call it, in different regions then, because there are certain areas where there definitely is more activity, more fines, if you will. I mean, Ohio, definitely that seems to be the prime one, right, almost?
Amazing fines all throughout Ohio, involving universities, Smithsonian. Well, if you take a look at it, I mean, the problem with America is that we think of it in terms of states, and so we have blinders on. You know?
Right.
I mean, something can be in Indiana, and it's only 20 miles away from Ohio, but we think it's somehow different. And when you really look at a map of America, you'll see that all the way from West Virginia and Pennsylvania, there's you know, basically a swath of valleys and forests and rivers that continue all the way to the Mississippi River. And these were covered in huge earthworks. Hundreds of thousands of them. One Smithsonian report says that they thought in the East Coast alone there was over 100,000 mounds. And some of them, like Cahokia, are larger in mass than the Great Pyramid. But the majority, 80-90% of all these sites have been destroyed over the years. And the government has not protected hardly any of them until very recently. Some of them, Cahokia didn't get a heritage status until the 1960s, and I have articles from 1905 when they were trying to save these things.
Oh, boy. Now, I know that there's some interesting things you bring up later in the book. I want to get there in terms of some of the, you know, more or less lost cities and things that we've, you know, largely forgot about. But if we look at what's left already, then we have, you know, the Serpens Mounds in Ohio. We have the around the Mississippi Valley, tons of different earthworks and everything else. What do you think was the purpose of these sites?
Well, they seem to have been divided into four or five different categories. The extremely large ceremonial sites, like the ones found in Charleston, Wheeling, West Virginia, all the way through Cahokia, are certainly, you know, primarily ceremonial. But they've also discovered giant burials in there. You find literally temples that are inside of these mounds, log cabins inside the mounds, huge standing stones. They're very elaborate and full of grave goods as well. And then there's the smaller mounds with a lesser rank of burial, but then there's a huge number of them called effigy mounds, which are pictorial mounds. And the number of animals, squirrels, lizards, ducks, snakes, birds. There's reports of ones formed in the shape of humans, mastodons, elephants. I mean, the list just goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
There's an area of Wisconsin that was literally carpeted with these effigy mounds. I liken it to the Nazca Plains down in South America in terms of pictorial complexity. I mean, they were so in touch with nature and so in tune with their environment. You know, I think that they envisioned it as a huge natural tapestry that they were just augmenting and enhancing. And there's not a lot of evidence of defensive structures. It does not seem to have been, you know, an extremely warlike society.
Right. So let's try to tackle this one in terms of what actually made them into giants. I mean, we have, you bring that up in the book as well. There are certain, you know, gigantism, there are certain things that are, comes about because of tumors in the right, or should we say wrong place in the brain and everything else. But it seems to me that they were, it's the properties of the earth that was different. We've seen all kinds of animals in the past basically being gigantic. There's something that changed, and possibly even through the you know, catastrophism kind of lens, if you will, that we had something that changed the properties so dramatically on the earth that the properties for being this large just went away. What do you think?
I tend to agree with that. I've heard some very fanciful theories that even gravity may have been different before the last cataclysm. But there's no question that when you look overall at the record of animals, they tend to get smaller over time. They don't get bigger. Dinosaurs ended up like birds, right? You know, birds didn't grow into dinosaurs.
Right.
And you see the same thing, you know, with horses and pigs and all of these charts. Another thing, though, is if you notice, you know, having read through a lot of those accounts over and over and over again, they talk about how large the jaw was of the giant skeletons they're finding. They keep saying that they could slip it over their heads, and that the bones themselves, in many cases, seemed to be thicker. The skulls were thicker. And although I don't theorize it on the book, because I really don't have any proof one way or the other, I'm coming to the conclusion that these may be Cro-Magnon.
Uh-huh, yeah.
You know? And that the elongated skulls, giant skulls, that they've also found in West Virginia and other places in the United States, and obviously lots of them in South America, I think may be what are referred to as the original gods. You know, in the Greek myths, you had the gods, then you had the titans, and then you had us, basically. And that's sort of what I think the lineage is of what these finds in America are telling us.
And what do you make, then, about the conflicts between these different species, that it's basically us who hunted some of the giants to extinction because of, well, there could be various reasons for that, but it seems to have been conflict at some point in history between the races, at least.
Well, there is some evidence, including the Paiute Indian stories, of them hunting the last of these giants into extinction. There's also the sort of general Indian stories that pertain to two things. One seems to be volcanic fumes they talk about, which would indicate some of the Lassen volcano activity I mentioned earlier. But they also mentioned disease. And as we saw when officially recognized history says that Europeans made contact with the Americas, there was huge disease spread and die off. It would seem to me that maybe something similar happened with the giants.
Right, right.
I mean, for instance, they could have been susceptible to the Black Plague, you know. And I'm beginning to think that the Mongol invasion not only went towards Europe, but also went towards America.
Huh.
Those dates are almost identical to the real drop-off of the mound builder culture. It basically collapsed around then.
And what date did you put on that again?
It's around 1200 AD.
Right.
Between 1200 and 1400 AD, which is the same time as the Black Plague. And it wouldn't, you know, people ask me, well, what do you think knocked them off? And I'm beginning to think, you know, it could have been, you know, widespread disease.
Huh. And this was brought from different parts of the world again. And just this idea to reiterate that again, that it was nothing that was blocking anybody from jumping onto a boat and sailing, you know, anywhere in the world, right?
Well, and I'll tell you something. 2 days ago, I was sent by a friend a report from Santa Rosa Island in California, which is one of the Channel Islands, and we'll talk about all the giants found out there. But this is a Smithsonian is leading this dig on Santa Rosa Island. They found 19 sites. Now, they haven't reported finding any skeletons yet, but if they're going to go over there and do more digging, and I think it's inevitable that they're going to come across them. But they've carbon dated the remains that they found at these 19 sites, and they've got dates of up to 11,000 BC, and unquestionably the use of boats. And they're beginning to backtrack on this whole theory that they walked, you know, from Alaska through the glaciers.
Right. Yeah. Fascinating. Now,
because I mean, you know, Australians, Aborigines, you know, we have history 40,000 years of boat use. I mean, a log drops in the water, you can jump on it, and you've got a boat, right? How hard is that to figure out?
Right. Exactly. Yeah, it's true. I don't know why. Well, again, it's part of this overall cover up in this one version of. Of
one
history.
Version of history that you're allowed to consider.
Yeah. And you list that in the book as well. You speculate there was many different reasons actually at the time that the Smithsonian did it this way. What would you say some of those other were? We talked briefly about the Mormon kind of connection there,
well,
but there's others.
You have a potential legal problem in the United States is that if you start recognizing European influence prior to Columbus, then you're opening the door to various countries and ethnicities within the United States and elsewhere claiming patrimony for the country.
Right.
So if you shut the door completely and say it never happened, then nobody can step forward. You can't have people saying, well, the Vikings discovered. Well, no, the Romans discovered. Well, no, the Egyptians. You know?
It's really fascinating. And one of the things that's happened though lately, there is has been a little bit more focus, for example, on the Clovis culture coming over here. I don't know how many years ago now, but speculating from 10,000 to maybe even more. And there's people within the Smithsonian now, even people like Dennis Stanford. And I think you talk about another person in the book that actually do some interesting work on this.
Yep. No, the Smithsonian is trying very hard internally, I think, to ease themselves out of a very sticky situation that they painted themselves in the last 100 years. The Clovis points, which were originally found out in New Mexico, they're finding Clovis points on the East Coast dating back 14,000 BC now. I go into the Meadowcroft Cavern in Pennsylvania, where a lot of stuff's been taken out, and James Antavasia, who wrote The First Americans, is involved in that, as well as the bog mummies found down in Florida, which they've dated to 7,500 BC.
Yeah, tell us more about that.
Well, it's an incredible story. They were building a real estate development in Titusville, which is a little bit west of Disney World, and they discovered a bunch of skeletons and contacted the University of Florida and University of Miami and the state regulators and so on and so forth, and could not get any funding or support for the thing, but they eventually got the academic community to go investigate it, and some guys from Florida State and the University of Florida began to raise funds privately, which they were able to use, and developers donated $60,000 worth of equipment to drain one of these lakes there, and at the bottom of it, they found a peat moss base, and in that peat moss base, they found over, I think, 180 skeletons with intact tissue and red hair, all of it knotted, and then they were ritually staked in ceremonial burials similar to the finds that they've made in Welsh bog mummies.
Huh.
And then in the West Coast, there's a series of health spas there, and one of the guys that was running one of them was an ex-Navy diver, and he started discovering skeletons at the bottom of those that actually they thought these lakes were only 40 feet deep, and they were actually sort of hourglass-shaped, and they went down 200 feet. And down in those, they've found skeletons that they've carbon dated back to 10,000 BC. Then on the islands of the Florida-Georgia coast, they were building a luxury airport for the vacationers there, and they discovered several hundred giant mummies there. Not mummies, but skeletons. And it continues in Texas. I've got an account from the 1930s where the WPA, the University of Texas, and the Smithsonian found a giant skull that they characterize as the largest ever found, and they posit in the article inhabitation of 40 to 50,000 BC in the area.
Wow.
Then you go up to Oklahoma and the Texas-Arkansas border where the Cato culture is. Again, huge finds of giants. Same thing at Moundsville in Alabama, all the way up to Minnesota. I mean, it's all over the country.
Yeah. And if we get back to the giants a little bit, what would distinguish the length, the how tall they were? Because it seems it ranges from anything over, I guess, 7 feet, sometimes 6.5 maybe, but anything over 7 feet, that begins to come into the giant territory.
Yeah, that's usually the, you know, there's a couple where they include some 6'8" guys, but it's mostly 7 foot to 9 feet.
Yeah.
And then there's a lesser number of finds of 10 to 12 feet. And then there's one extraordinary article that's very well sourced of a find on the Ohio-Indiana border of an 18-foot giant who was found with a 9-foot sword and an iron helmet, which in the article they characterize as resembling something manufactured in Ninva. And this skeleton was viewed by hundreds of townspeople and then shipped to New York. And again, we don't know what happened to it.
They all seem to disappear. It's amazing. I mean, is there any indication in the reports you've gone through that, all right, it's going to be dug up, or are we going to, you know, preserve it in some way, or anything about what happened to them? I mean,
Over and over again, it says, you know, it was either sent to a local museum or it was sent to the Smithsonian. In many cases, there's a Smithsonian representative saying, we're tremendously excited. This is one of the most amazing things we've ever found.
Yeah.
I have an 1883 field report from the Smithsonian, which is virtually impossible to find. And in there, the Smithsonian themselves, in the report, found a 7-foot 4-inch and a 7-foot giant, and incredible amounts of associated burial goods, very high quality pottery, some of it with cord markings, which is very interesting because some of the earliest pottery ever officially identified is the Anu culture pottery, and that dates to 10,000 BC, and those are the purported navy white remnant civilization in northern Japan, and cord mark pottery has also been found in around Stonehenge.
Yeah. Wow, it's so fascinating. Let's talk a little bit more then about the Catalin Island find before we take a break here in a little bit. What was this about, and when was this discovered?
Catalin Island is off the coast of Los Angeles, and in the 1920s. It was owned by the Wrigley Chewing Gum family, and they had a museum, and the archaeologist at the museum was a man named Ralph Glidden, who was actually an heir to the Glidden paint fortune, and he conducted a series of digs, not only in Catalina, but some of the associated Channel Islands between 1919 and 1930. Now, he found and excavated one of four burial grounds that he identified in Catalina. Out of that, he took 3,781 skeletons, averaging 7 feet tall, the tallest being 9'2". And it's estimated that altogether he found over 5,000 skeletons in the Channel Islands. Now, this was reported not only nationally but internationally. I reproduce a Sunday supplement article, the front page, that was appeared all over the country documenting all this. Now, Glidden not only was the curator of the Catalina Museum Island, but he also ran the Hay Foundation, which was part of the Smithsonian. And at the gift shop on Catalina, he actually began selling the bones. And it was a huge tourist attraction, and it was all shut down in the 1930s. There's some interesting stories related to that, but basically the whole thing was wiped out of the history books. Now, 2 or 3 years ago, the newly incorporated Catalina Island Museum was doing a thing on World War II, and they were back in the storage bins, and they apparently found several boxes of Glidden's material. Brought it out and said, oh, we're just completely amazed, never heard, you know, heard about this, never knew where any of this material was. Now, the Los Angeles Times and other local newspapers out there all reported on it, but again, they refused to talk about how many skeletons were found, the fact that they were giants, and they keep referring to Ralph Glidden as a crackpot amateur archaeologist.
Right, yeah.
When he was a curator, and he worked for the Smithsonian. And in the book, I show that the Smithsonian has in their restricted files over 500 pictures that they... No one in the Los Angeles Times seemed to have, you know, done any research and found that, you know, this stuff has been archived and sitting hidden from the American public. And the California finds are just astonishing. There's a 9-foot skeleton they found in San Diego that the Smithsonian apparently bought. There's an amazing report from Nevada News concerning an underground temple complex in an area behind Death Valley that involved 8 to 9 foot giants dressed in what they called at the time sheepskin-looking zoot suits, as well as altars, reliquaries, and carved niches that had saber-toothed tigers, mammoths, and dinosaurs. Now, you might say dinosaurs.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. Huh.
Completely ridiculous. Well, that's what I thought. So I started doing some research, and it turns out that there's a very highly accredited scientist at the North Carolina State, as well as a man from Germany with a PhD, and they both independently have been cutting open dinosaur bones recently, and they found soft tissue in the dinosaur bones. And they've done testing on the soft tissue and dated it at 20 to 36,000 BC. Now, they tried to present a paper at a very prestigious Singapore conference last year, and the paper was pulled out of circulation, and the directors refused to even discuss it. So this we're having the same problem, you know, up to the present time. Now, the researcher at North Carolina State, you know, she's been attacked for the last 10 years. You know, they keep saying, oh, it's contaminated, it's this, it's that.
Right.
And they keep retesting. And it's very interesting because there's also petroglyphs out in Lee Canyon in Arizona of dinosaurs. And then I don't know if you're familiar with the Ica stones down in South America.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Stones down there that show men battling dinosaurs.
Exactly.
I don't go into it much in the book, but it's something to think about.
Well, indeed, exactly. I mean, this is what it's all about, finding those out-of-place artifacts, trying to, you know, find the pieces that do contradict history, because it begs us the question to re-examine it and look it over again. And the fact is that if we have reports from a certain period so prominent in many newspapers and all around the world, and then all of a sudden they just begin to disappear, and it's been like an agreement that, okay, this is a no-touching issue. We're not going to talk about this anymore.
Yeah, verboten, precisely. You talk about this, you lose your funding.
Yeah.
And that's the other problem, is that the universities took their lead from the Smithsonian. So when the Powell Doctrine was introduced and forbidding any recognition of European or Asian contact in the Americas, by extension, the universities then refused to do any study in it. And when these things are found, eventually the bureaucracy gets involved. They're shipped either to the Smithsonian or a cooperating museum like the Carnegie Museum in Pennsylvania that's taken in a lot of these things. And that's the last you hear of them.
Okay, let me ask you a couple of more things here before I take a break. And it's more related to the Smithsonian in that regard. And it's like, how, I mean, they have that interesting institution building that's called the Castle and everything. I mean, I don't know how many different places they have around the country, but in the U.S., but is there any speculation as to where they would actually keep all these finds?
In storage is all I can figure out.
Like anywhere that doesn't give away that it's the Smithsonian stuff.
Somewhere that's very difficult and uncatalogued.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. So how much power do they have, the Smithsonian?
Well, they pretty much wrote the scientific doctrine for all of the 20th century in terms of adhering to a strict scientific line. You know, in some respects, the Smithsonian prided itself in being a scientific institution based on Darwinism and strict science. And you have giant stories in mythology in the Bible, and that, I think, made scientists very uncomfortable. So they don't want to get into any of those areas. And, you know, we talked about manifest destiny and a lot of other things that it went into this as well. You know, the idea that there was high culture and so on and so forth would have made it a lot more difficult for them to just sweep across the country and exterminate the indigenous populations that they found here. So, you know, but you know, the same thing is in Europe. I mean, there's mounds all over Europe and giant finds there, and they've equally been suppressed.
That's right. Exactly. It's a cross the world kind of issue. Now, let's just talk a little bit before we take a break here about how people can get a hold of copies of the book. I mean, I just want to mention that it's fascinating, and the reports are just, you know, gold to read through. They're so fascinating, and you weave them together, you know, into the story, if you will, as you tell them, and they're scattered throughout the book, and it's just really fascinating. Now, do you have a personal website, or should we send people to, you know, the publisher to pick up a copy?
It's available on Amazon and Kindle, and it's been the number one book in archaeology and alternative history on and off for the last 2 weeks on both those sites. It's also available in all the Barnes & Noble stores, Simon & Schuster. And also the internationally, it's available at major bookseller websites in England and France, Canada, and Australia. So if you want a copy, you can find one pretty easily.
Very good. We're going to have it linked up as well. It's called The Ancient Giants Who Ruled America, and we're going to have Amazon.com and the publisher up there. Do you have a personal website, Richard, you want to give out?
No, I don't. I just have Facebook.
All right. We can link that up if you want to. But, okay, great stuff. Some nice things to check into. We have much more to discuss here with Richard Dewhurst. So stay with us, everybody. We'll be right back after this break.
Fire and wind come from the sky, from the gods of the sky. But Crumb is your god. Crumb, and he lives in the earth. Once giants lived in the earth, Conan. And in the darkness of chaos, they fooled Crumb. And they took from him the enigma of steel. Crumb was angered, and the earth shook. And fire and wind struck down these giants, and they threw their bodies into the waters. But in their rage, the gods forgot the secret of steel and left it on the battlefield. And we who found it are just men. Not gods, not giants, just men. And the secret of steel has always carried with it a mystery. You must learn its riddle, Conan. You must learn its discipline. For no one in this world can you trust. Not men, not women, not beasts. This you can trust.
We are going to continue with Richard Dewhurst in the second hour at redicemembers.com, our members website where we have all our programs in full archived. That also includes our video material, films, audio commentaries, and more. redicemembers.com. And for our open archive and the full newsfeed, check out redicecreations.com. Upcoming, we have Ben Davidson, William Lyne, William Mullen, Robert Felix, and Sophia Smallstorm. Stay tuned for much more radio on exciting and essential topics. We'll see you after the break. Hour 2 with Richard Dewhurst coming up.